and ETAPs. Now the ship go with the Blighty, as we called it, in the army, to Manchester, England. I was put into the big infirmary in Manchester, which is one of the biggest hospitals in England, I guess. And there, I developed gangrene. The doctors wanted to amputate my leg for a while. So I had six doctors examine it one morning, and they all said that I should have it amputated. But there's a nurse, a big red-headed nurse, I always remember her. Her name was Miss Reed. She said she'd look after it and do the best she could for it. And she attended it night and day for about 3 days. And then one morning she fetched a magnifying glass and a pair of forceps, and she looked at the wound and found something that she could get hold of, and it was my pants had been driven in with the shrapnel, and she pulled it out. All dirt and mud. And after that, the color seems to come back into it. And it gradually got better. And I say, she saved my leg for me, for which I was very thankful. It's worth a lot of wooden ones. Whilst I was in that hospital, I saw some terrible sights and some terrible patients. One man especially had both legs up and one arm, yet he was the happiest soul there. He was always joking and having fun. And at that time I was marked out to a convalescent home in Levensholm. Rookhouse Levensholm, that was the name of the hospital that I went to. And after I left, I heard that Queen Mary had visited there, and all these different ones. And she met this man. I think she asked for something special to be done for him. I don't know what it was. In the army, you get many different tasks. I remember one time when we were in France, we were sent to load 9.2 shells, which weigh almost a ton. It took 3 hours to get them on a trolley, to get them loaded into the trucks. We were only allowed to put three to one of those big trucks. And they were moved on then to the artillery range to where they were to be fired. That we didn't know where they went to, but we just loaded them. I had a friend named Bill Perkins. He was sergeant gunner in one of those large capacity gun emplacements. And he was one time buried with one of the big shells that came in to knock out his artillery. He was buried right down, and his men could hear him groaning and were digging him out. And another shell came and killed the ones that were digging him out and threw him back on top. He didn't know about it until he was taken out and laid out with the burial party. He said he knew everything that was going on, but he couldn't even raise a finger or even flick his eyelashes. And he's just waiting for the burial party to come along when the doctor said he was just going to have another look down the line. And he walked down and turned the eyelids back of each man. And he said when he got to him, he just managed to flick his eye when he was looking at it. The doctor said, take this man out and sit him right down in the emergency hospital. And he was there quite a while. He's in hospital for about 3 days before he knew anything, before he came to at all. And then he asked the nurse what time it was. She told him about 9 o'clock. And he went to sleep again. When I came to again, I asked her again what time it was. It was 9 o'clock, but it was the next day. And he said, when I got around and looked around, he said, I thought I was in heaven. I'd known Bill Perkins for many years. In fact, we were neighbors in Meadow Lake, Saskatchewan. And there we, amongst us, my brother was returned there too. We got the Legion started. We're all chartered members, and he became president for several years. And after we moved to the coast here, he lived on Obed Street. And I was at Tadbury Bay. We used to do a lot of visiting between one and the other. And a great friend until he moved to the Okanagan, where he died. In fact, he died in 1982, just sometime around Christmas time. After moving from a big infirmary in Manchester, we moved to a hospital, a convalescent hospital, called Brookhouse, Levenshulme, which is a very notable place in the early days. I think it was Dick Turpin that used to tie his horse there when he went on the raids in England. And it was still there, a big hollow oak tree. And it was right by the home of Moseley. And she had a beautiful place, big gardens. And she drove all the as the boats came in, she met the boats and brought the wounded people into hospitals. It was her that brought me in. And then she moved me again from the infirmary to Brook House. And I got to know her quite well during the years. And she'd come and get me when different fruits were ripe, and we'd go picking fruit together, like cherries or plums or whatever the hospital could use. We used to go and pick them and bring them back to the hospital. As a patient in Brook House for over 8 months, that's where I met my future wife and was married in Calgary. We were married in Calgary on November the 13th, 1919. And we moved to Edmonton that winter, stayed in Edmonton for the winter. Then we moved on to the homestead when spring came. My wife's maiden name was May Fawkes, F-A-U-X. And she's a special nurse, at least my special nurse, whilst I was in hospital in Brook House. And I was discharged at Buxton in December 1917 and was on the boat coming back to Canada for Christmas 1917, New Year 1918. And I arrived sometime in January in Calgary again. Put in the time for the next 2 years. During that time, we corresponded all the time until November 1919. Then we were married, and I've got that all enough now. In the recruiting days, you don't realize just what's going to happen. In fact, we made up our minds in this little village of Elnora, and there were 15 of us left on the same train. And practically all enlisted in the same battalion, but different companies, was put in different companies and different platoons. And then we found our own friends in our own companies. And you only meet each other casually once in a while. But you never forget your old friends. During the winter of 1916, we were attached to the 1st Entrenching Battalion, which was billeted at Billeter-Boy. And I remember there meeting a boy that shouldn't have been in the Army because he was underage. He passed his 16th birthday before we went over at Vimy. And he became attached to me, and he'd never leave me, just used to watch him, fell in with me. Every time we fell in, he always managed to get alongside of me, wherever we went. Lots of times, when we were marching, his pack would get too heavy for him, and I'd carry it for him. And he became so attached to me that he'd do anything for me. I think he was alongside of me when I was wounded. His name was Derpak. He was a Russian-Canadian, but he was just as staunch as any staunch Canadian as any of them that were there. Another man I remember very well was named Lindsay Elliott. We're in the same rifle club together, and the Knee Hill Rifle Club. Finally, he joined the 31st and became the Armory Sergeant of the 31st. I think he was mentioned one time at Bisley. He won medals at Bisley. And by him, I think it was how the Ross Rifle was banned by him overseas. He was instrumental in getting it banned. After the war, Lindsay, I think, became agent for the DuPont Powder and Ammunition Company, and all over, traveling all over Alberta and Saskatchewan. I remember after leaving the camp at East Sandling in England, we arrived on the coast, I think it's at Dover, and we loaded on the boat way after dark and arrived in Le Havre, France. From there, we were lined up and the riot act was read to us of what we could do and what was punishable by death or firing squad or what was punishable by first penal punishment. And from there on, we went to camp for 10 days to finish our training. I don't remember just what they called the camp, but the commander, they all called him Jip the Blood. This was in late September 1916, where we went up to train at this camp. Why they called the commander Jip the Blood, I've no idea. I think it was because he'd been over and gone through a lot of it and wounded himself. I guess many others in the Army will remember the same camp because every contingent that went over had to go before him and trained by him. We also left the camp at Le Havre by night. First thing, we walked up about 200 steps in full pack, I always remember that, and we got the train, and I don't remember what town it was we got off, but we're marching on. We're supposed to be a draft of the 16th. We'll be waylaid in Villeter-Boy. And we were taken into the 1st Entrenching Battalion there. But we're all very hungry on the way. I remember passing through a turnip field, and I think every man had a turnip in his hand when he got through eating turnips. And when we arrived, with no time left to ourselves at all, we just sent right on up the line to, I remember passing through Crancy and stopping at Souchez Dump. They'd had a lot of casualties at that time. And when we got to Souchez, it was around midnight, but a moonlight night. My first occupation here was to guard the dead from the rats. I remember that very well. Souchez Dump, as many will remember, was where all the rations were unloaded out of the trucks, and the ammunition for the line. When they unloaded the ammunition, rations, they placed the dead in the trucks and took them back to the burial grounds and cemeteries. Having been primed beforehand about seeing lots of dead, it wasn't such a shock to me to see the dead, and therefore it didn't make a lot of them faint that would have fainted probably. There was also a light gauge railway connected with Souchez Dump. It came right into the dump and went right on through the McDonald Cut, right to the big tunnel that they put in that run right under the German lines. And that was blown out at the Bimmy, and the guns went right through ahead of the Germans. There's also a light gauge railway running right along the foot of the ridge. And nothing else to do, they named it King's Cross. I remember working along that railway many times. I saw a lot of casualties there at different times. The miniature railway that run alongside of Vimy Ridge, and the bridge on the one side and a swamp on the other, and they often shelled and just missed the track, but covered it with mud and slush. One morning we were working there, and laughing and joking as we went, said, covered the track with about 4 feet of mud and stuff, we had to shovel that back. And joking and saying, it's no good taking it up because they'll only put it back again. No sooner had they said that than one dropped right in front of us, covered us with mud and dirt. An officer yelled, "Take cover." We rushed into this sap that was running under the ridge. And I guess I was the last one in because a shell dropped right on the top of the door jamb just as I was going in, knocked me forward. I remember when I came to, I was bleeding at my ears, my eyes and my nose. And one of the Red Cross men rushed down and treated me there. But that was all. In the spring of 1916, and the fall of 1916 and the spring of 1917, all the work around Vimy had to be done at night work. And a lot of it was task work, where two men had to do something. We were burying cable. It was all lined out for us. We had to start in the width of the long handle, or 7 feet, we had to be 7 feet long. And the width of a long handle of spade at the top, we had to go down 7 feet. That was a task work for two. Lots of times when you're digging, as lots of men know, you struck limestone and you got about 4 feet down and it all had to be picked with a shovel. But you had to go down 7 feet before you could quit so that the cable could be laid down in the bottom of it. And there may be 400, 500 men all in line, and all the trench joined. It all joined so that it made one long trench. You're through. And the cable was then put in, and it had to be buried and camouflaged before morning, because we were, and I had to go right into the front line. And so that when we started, they'd have communications all ready to use. From Bill as a boy to Souchez Dump, where we had to go to do this, most of this work, we had to cross through the Carency Valley, and the French had a big battle there, and the grass was growing up through a lot of the French dead when we were there. I don't know how many they lost, but it must have been tremendous. All this territory I'm speaking about was taken back from the Germans. They'd been right up to as far as Bill as a boy. And lots of times they didn't have time to get rid of the dead, and they buried them right there where they fell. And when they were doing these burying cable, many times they struck these bodies and had to remove them or go through them, get down to the 7 feet. In the early part of the war, I understand that there's so many casualties that lots of times they had to call a truce on each side to bury the dead. I don't know when that was, but I think it was after that Battle of Carency when that happened once. I was brought up in England by a very strict Anglican family, Church of England, in England it was called. And I had four sisters who were very prominent in the church choir. And I used to have a lot of tuition by them and all the things to do with the church. My eldest sister, Annie, was the one that had the special, always special to me, because she was about 20 years older than I was, more like a mother to me after mother died. And she was always talking about the different things to do with Christianity, and I listened to her a lot. And I'm just getting down to where, when I was going over the top at Vimy, when we were in the trenches, just all ready to go over, I suddenly had a vision. I was just wide awake at the time, but in front of me there was a bed with white sheets on, and my sister was kneeling by this bed with a white nightdress on, praying for me. After I saw that, I didn't mind. I just didn't really care about anything. And just about that time, somebody yelled, "We're away." And we went over the top, and I saw everything that I'd seen in a dream before, even to the time I was wounded. In the previous dream, before I joined the army at all, I dreamed that I was struck by a piece of shell casing and cut absolutely in two. And I saw my two halves, oh, 3 or 4 feet apart. And I wondered how I could get joined together again. And and when the real thing came in there, at Vimy, my rifle was bent double just before with a piece of shell casing. And instead of being cut in two, I threw it down and picked up another rifle that was just been left vacant. And at that time, I got wounded in the leg. And when I was wounded, I saw everything that I saw in the previous dreams. except I was whole, I wasn't cut in two. But had not my rifle been in the position it was, I probably would have been.